Thank you for that. There are a lot of people who don't enjoy audio, so I've set up a video camera, and I'm videotaping these as well as audio recording them. It takes a lot more time to edit the video than it does to set up the audio, but it's a project that I thought I would play with, so just adds a little bit more technicality to these sessions. So I have to change the tape after 1 hour. Thank you for your patience.
Well, you are by yourself there, though, huh?
Well, yes. My life, what I'm doing. So let me see. I agree, that went by much quicker than I thought, so it's nice. And I am bookmarking and keeping in mind the questions people ask, and I do very much appreciate them, because the work is about what you do, not about what anybody says, and not about phrases, and not about bullet points, and not about objective reality. The work that we do in Pathwork is all about a very, very deep subjective reality, where, again, in the most wonderful way, you're the only one who knows whether something is a distortion or simply a discomfort. And it is in the exploration of that discomfort where you can either resolve and say, well, I was just uncomfortable. There was a conflict there, but it's not major. I have looked there. I haven't found any negativity. I haven't found any negative intentionality. And, you know, I'm going to let it go. I give up. I'm just going to let go of the fact that I drink too much coffee or I spend too much time with my friends. It's a value judgment. I'll try to get over it. But I can't find a distortion in it. I really think it may be more positive than negative, and I'm going to let it go. Versus another activity that could be just as innocuous and yet hold distortion. By distortion, what we're talking about is a false belief that you will not let go of, a prejudice, a place where you are ready to give up negative behavior except for this one. This negative behavior, that's not negative. This negative behavior is actually positive. Well, that's a distortion. Even in saying that, you ought to be able to see that. But I've been through this myself with my stuff, and you can say it and not get it. And so part of the joy of what the guide presents is congratulations if you're in distortion and in negativity, it will show up someplace else. And you won't be able to keep this to yourself. You won't be able to hide the picture of Dorian Gray. At some point, the two are going to come together, even if you can stall it off a very, very long time. Okay? So when I talk about, I'm going to go back to cause and effect for a second. In the place where someone truly does a negative act and truly does not pay a human or society price for it, the idea that they're getting away with something is ludicrous. Because imagine what this soul is going to have to carry in the next lifetime. You don't truly think that if you escape justice in this lifetime, you're off the hook. And if you are so sly and negative and determined to stay negative in this lifetime, you may give yourself a spectacularly difficult task the next time through. And this is where somebody getting away with something could actually be in alignment with their spiritual task. They may need to get away with something on a human level to find out you can't get away with it on a spiritual level. And to find out that the consequences are much, much worse on a spiritual level than if you just spent the jail time or if you just gave back the money. Even to the point where if you just told somebody, I'm sorry. But holding these negativities and trying to pretend that they don't exist have far more cumulative affect than the societal price that we are sometimes asked to take as punishment for our negative behavior. Okay? So that cause and effect. The other topic that's addressed in this lecture, even though it's mild, is resistance. Okay? And this is where the quote is, your life reveals what your underlying beliefs and attitudes must be. It cannot be otherwise. Your life reveals what your underlying beliefs and attitudes must be. It cannot be otherwise. And the short version of that is your life does not lie. Now, when I work with people individually and I work with people in groups, I make two presumptions. Number one, that they're willing to hear the spiritual version, and they're not going to insist, but I didn't get caught, so I'm not guilty. And the second thing I assume is that they feel that there's something not right. Okay, happy, content people don't try to rush to therapy sessions. That's just not what they do. They have better things to do with their time and their money. Okay? So even if they're not quite ready or able to admit it, anybody who comes into therapy groups, workshops, that kind, anybody who comes into this force field that has the potential to heal, not that we heal, but we can facilitate the self-healing of a person. But anybody who's attracted to the force field of self-healing and becoming more conscious, their attraction is because that's what they want. The truth is that that part of them may be very, very tiny, not well-developed, sleepy, lazy, so that they try to get on the merry-go-round and they fall off. Okay, and they pick themselves up and they try to get on and they fall off. And at some point they may say, this is ridiculous, the merry-go-round, you should, you know, and they storm off in a huff. Okay? From a spiritual perspective, something happened here. They reached out. They weren't able to get on the bus. They weren't able to get on the merry-go-round. And they decided to continue the way they were continuing. That's one story. Another is that in the reaching out, they also made a decision to change, and that decision to change will continue to be active even though the initial vehicle they chose did not seem appropriate. And this is how I try to understand people who contact me and then never contact me again. That there was something they needed in one lecture or one piece of paper or one phone conversation that would serve their purpose, even though continued conversations and continued work don't seem to be appropriate to their life task. Other people stay longer. When I did this work, I wound up being a pathwork helper. I didn't know that was going to happen. I made this my life work because I love it so much. That's simply another shade in the spectrum. Okay? So, if your life reveals what your underlying beliefs and attitudes must be, if you have an underlying belief and attitude that nobody can help, even if there's a positive part of you that reaches out for help, that negative part of you is going to pull you away. The negative part of you will critique the teacher, critique the group, critique the air conditioning, critique the kind of tea served during breaks. It's going to critique something. It's going to argue with the materials or say it's too much or too much work or too little. Something's going to become a vehicle to justify your pulling out. If you have led a life where one part of you tries to learn and another part of you, and these phrases are just, you know, it's arbitrary, there's no, you're one unified thing, but it feels like you reach out with the left hand for something and the right hand slaps you and pulls back or makes you drop it. That's the place where work can be done. Okay, something's going on there. If you reach out for something and you get it and bring it in and it becomes integrated with your life and it's all positive, don't worry about it. Probably a positive thing. If you reach out for something and it simply doesn't seem to function, and you can't get excited about it, you have no eros for it, and it just falls away from your life and it doesn't seem to bother you, maybe it wasn't important. Maybe that was a rational thought pattern. This might help. When the reality is, your unconscious is telling you, no, it won't help. So while you may not be able to speak directly to your unconscious, the trick is to look at the evidence laying in front of you. So another phrase from the lecture that says that is that the negative force field can sometimes take the form of an image. I'm setting up the quote. This isn't in the lecture. But there are a lot of Patrick lectures on images, because an image is like a vortex or a force field. If we have an image of ourselves as beautiful, and this is fairly common nowadays, although the way we phrase it may be new agey, it's a fairly well-known thing. Any woman who thinks she's beautiful tends to be perceived as beautiful. Any man who thinks he's handsome tends to be perceived as handsome. And then sometimes you get a picture of this person and go, whoa, big nose, hairy chin, bad hairline. Why did I ever think this person was attractive? Because their auric field was attractive. Because they were putting out a welcome. They were putting out a pretty, a beautiful, a handsome energy that made you feel good, and you thought it was their visage. You thought it was their face. The contrary thing would be you can have a very physically attractive person who's ugly. And sometimes you can actually see it, and it's almost bizarre that even though the face itself is beautiful, there's an ugliness about it.
Yeah.
And that would be the force field that they're surrounding themselves with, that they're emanating or attracting. Understand that whether you attract it or emanate it, it's just, in that moment there may be more putting out than bringing in, but it's the same mechanism. You wouldn't attract it to you if you didn't want it. And you wouldn't emanate it if you didn't want to do that. Okay? So the quote is that the image has to be dissolved. And the creative energy that was locked up in the image is from now on to be utilized in ways that are compatible with the divine law. And one of the things that's in here, it's not expressed well in this particular quote, but part of what the guide is saying is you take that image, you take all that energy and that interaction that you're doing that you're not aware of, and you clean it up. And now you have the ability to use that energy flowing from you and flowing in from others for positive purposes. So in sports, it's called a point swing. So if somebody gains 5 points, I don't quite know how it works, but basically when you stop going into debt and going into savings, that's a huge change. It's not a small change. It's massive. It changes everything. So what the guide is saying is that if you dissolve this image, if you dissolve this force field so it's not operating for the purpose of negativity, and the creative energy, because this took energy. This was hard work to bring all this negativity in. You had to work to shove that negativity out. It's not a passive thing. It doesn't just flow like water out of a spring. But the creative energy that was locked up in the image is from now on can be, I'm going to translate this, can be utilized in ways that are compatible with divine law. You have more time and energy on your hands for the positive because you're no longer spending it.
And then if that changes, you should be able to see the change in your circumstances in your life, right?
Yes. I'm going to...
As you're attracting, if you're observing what you're attracting at different times, maybe you will notice what you perceive as an improvement of your what you're attracting as you change.
So if you, I'm going to take that as yes. If you do a clean transformation, you'll see results.
Uh-huh.
What concerns me sometimes is this is where people use should, and the reality is it has to happen. It's not a should.
Right.
It's absolute. If you're putting out positive energy, and you were putting out negative energy, there's a sea change. There's no doubt whatsoever. The trick is there may be reasons why it doesn't manifest in ways that you expect. That's where it gets tricky here.
Oh, yeah. So you're making a judgment about what should be there instead of just allowing the principles to work, huh?
Right. So to some extent, if you have seen the light and you have decided that you were negative and you're now going to be positive, and there's a condition in there, a secret condition, an informal unwritten contract, and then I'll get rich, right? Well, not necessarily. You may stay poor.
Right.
Poor is not inherently negative. And you always have the choice on how you approach things. Your interpretation is always a matter of attitude rather than circumstance. So any expectation that you put on making this change, spiritual law might decide to challenge you and find out how committed you are by not giving you that expectation. Not getting reinforcement could be another spiritual test coming right after the first one.
I read something, I don't remember whether it was Pathwork or what, but I wrote it down as a thought because it's a sort of an attitude of expectancy, but not expectation.
Mm-hmm. It might have been, something like that might have been in the lectures, yeah. So expectancy is an openness.
Uh-huh.
Whereas expectation is a veiled demand.
Yeah, I never thought of the difference of those two words, but that it kind of clarifies things.
So the last quote on this resistance part, and the reason I'm listing this under resistance is that if you have an image of yourself and you change the image and you don't get what you expect, you can use that to reinforce the idea that you weren't doing anything wrong in the first place. And this can be part of your resistance, where you're not doing it because you want to, but you will grudgingly do it if you can get a reward out of it. That's really resistance to positive process. Okay? So, in this lecture, the quote is, as long as a deliberate negativity, a negative intentionality exists in you, the resistance to commune with your eternal spiritual self will be too great. So again, I'm going to go back to why don't murderers come to Pathwork therapy sessions. That's not their spiritual path. Okay? The reason you murdered in the first place is part of a huge series of events, and you're obviously headed down a certain path. To murder, normally we justify murdering, or to steal. We justify stealing. So the thief doesn't feel like he's stolen. He feels like he's balanced out the inequalities of social life. A murderer feels that he was betrayed or that the other person stole and needs to be given street justice. Okay, we've got a rationale in our head for why this is acceptable morally. Or I had to do it. I couldn't live if you lived, so I killed you so I could live. It's a survival thing. You shouldn't punish me. I was just trying to get along. Okay? As long as there's a commitment to deliberate negativity, a commitment to saying, I don't care about spiritual law, I wanted it my way. I wanted the money, I wanted the power, I wanted this person dead. That's a commitment to negativity. As long as that's there, there will be a resistance for you to go inwards and look at your motives. I know how logical that can be, but sometimes you have to experience it in your own life. So in a place in yourself, and again, I find that the people that I work with, sometimes their negativity is actually really tiny. And they have the privilege of having lives where they have enough to eat, and their rent usually gets paid, and they have clothes, and they have a family, and they have a friend, and something is still nagging at them. And that is a privilege, because it's giving you this enormous support network that you can burp up some negative quality that might have been too subtle to notice if other things were happening to you. So there are spiritual lessons that can be learned in a life of crisis. Spiritual lessons can be learned in the middle of a war. There is no place where you cannot learn spiritual lessons. But because your life does not lie, the question is, why are your circumstances the way they are? How would that support a spiritual task? And what task is in front of you? But if you cling to negativity, if you want your life to be perfect, and say, I really believe that I'm a good person and I live a good life and I should only see good things, so I'm just going to ignore negativity. That's a commitment to negativity. That's not a commitment to looking and cleaning and purifying and transforming. That's some kind of presumption that you're already perfect. And the guide indicates that that's not why we came here. We didn't come here because we were perfect. We came here because there's something that needs to be addressed, that human life is the perfect vehicle to address it with.
So at that moment, are you just supposed to ask for guidance and understanding?
That's one way to address it. A genuine, heartfelt, open prayer.
Yeah.
To understand usually yields something. Now, the trick is you may not see it. Just because your prayer got answered does not mean that you saw it. Okay?
Just because the prayer got answered doesn't mean that you saw it, or you don't see that the prayer gets answered.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm suggesting is this. You put your heart out and you say, God, I want to learn. I really do. Please allow me to learn. If your perception is that nothing happened, what if nothing happening is a challenge, a test of your own faith?
Yeah, also.
Right. Rather than a negative, rather than a punishment or God's busy and he doesn't have time for you today, what if a lack of answer is an invitation? I heard you. Now, I'd like to see how much work you're willing to do. And then we'll come up with a plan on helping you out. In other words, what's wrong with the idea that we're being asked to put forward first instead of having God put forward first?
Yeah. Well, it's not having the expectation of the answer that's supposed to come, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you're truly, truly open and you ask God for help and you don't get what you perceive as an answer.
Yeah.
Okay. Then the question would be, maybe I'm supposed to do some of this on my own. Let's get started. I've never met anybody who truly asked for help that didn't get any. But I have seen people, you know, and I'm sure you've heard these jokes about when the flood comes and the guy's on his roof and four rowboats come by and he keeps saying, no, 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 God will save me. And he drowns and he comes up in front of God. It's a long, shaggy story. And he stands in front of God and says, what's the problem? I was waiting for you. And the guy says, I sent four people to save you.
Oh.
What do you want? Okay?
Yeah.
That's what I mean by we may believe that God only helped this way. And yet, in a broader sense, we've got all kinds of people trying to help us because God has activated them. But we don't perceive it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a place in us where we're not looking. So that what I'm suggesting here is a positive and generous possibility that there's something there that you're not seeing. And how can you support yourself in seeing it? The lectures don't talk about people being bad. Okay? That's not in here. This is not an original sin kind of philosophy. The lectures talk about the fact that for you to get born is a statement of positive intentionality that outweighs everything else that happens. To get born generates and triggers a series of activities that are going to get you learning something. If not everything you imagine, at least something. Everybody wins, nobody loses. From my perspective, people who are attracted to the lectures have some level of excitement. They've kind of gotten this, and they want more. And so the lectures are suggesting ways for you to accelerate your spiritual progress. And this lecture talks about one way to accelerate your spiritual process is to find out where you are holding yourself back. So in the places where you are letting out or attracting negativity, work there. Because once you release that energy, look at how much more creative, positive energy you've got to go forward with. Rather than putting blame on this, you're bad, do this penance, etc. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good segue for me because the next part of this lecture, and some of these lectures are just chockers with subjects, and it's incredible. And you wonder sometimes, how can you teach it? Sometimes you only teach a half a lecture because that's all you can get through. So the next section of the lecture has to do with, and it's in the title, so the original title is Demagnetizing Negative Force Fields, Pain of Guilt, okay? And the guide distinguishes between guilt and remorse. Now keep in mind that the joke is there's a lecture on everything, and so there's already a lecture on real and false guilt. And there's also a wonderful lecture on restitution. Restitution for real guilt. And so these tie in. Well, the guide is delineating between false guilt that you are using to justify something, to keep you busy someplace else, versus real guilt that needs to be addressed. Okay? Real guilt requires that you do something. If you have hurt someone, and I went, like many people, I went through an emotional 12-step program, a 12-step program for codependence, went through that. And so I love 12-step. I think it's just simply another version of Pathwork. And one of the steps in 12-step is making restitution. And what they teach you is you don't have to go to the person that you harmed directly. That may not be possible. That person may not understand. It could cause an... It's a nice idea. If it is, great. Go apologize in person. But there are other ways to do restitution for the harm that you have actually done. You could write a heartfelt letter. You could find the truth about it so that you weren't holding blame, that you weren't secretly saying, yeah, I did it, but that kind of thing. You can work on yourself. You can do karmic action in another arena with the specific intent of paying for that guilt. Okay? So, if you are truly guilty of something, then you may need to pay back. But beating yourself up because of your guilt, who does that serve? And it prevents active restitution. So think of people who did something that they consider to be wrong in their youth, and they live a life of public service the rest of their life. Okay. Everybody wins on this one. So the whys and wherefores of what they did, it's not that you don't want to hide it, you don't want to minimize it, you don't want to blame somebody else or let the negativity fester. But you do want to consider whether there is any possibility where you could create true restitution, perhaps beyond the actual guilt that you hold. So basically tithing a little bit more than you need to so that you really feel the fullness of your desire to do restitution. So there's real guilt and what needs to be done about real guilt. And that includes guilt for pain you have inflicted or are still inflicting. So what this is addressing is you may be sorry, but you may also be continuing to do it. You may be in process of really getting that this is inappropriate, that whatever you're doing negatively shouldn't be done, however you're still engaged with it. That's real guilt. And you need to act on that. You need to do something. Take action with whatever it is. So that's real guilt. Then there There's also a quality of getting that you're guilty. So simply paying someone off. So if I wrong you, and the accident is worth $100, and I try to run away from it, and I finally say, no, I'm going to clean this up. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to write you a check for $500. And that's five times what the situation's worth. And I hand you the check for $500, but I've never actually absorbed the guilt. I've never actually absorbed my intention to cheat another human being, to claim innocence where there was no innocence, to allow that person to undergo hardship and to turn away hoping I could get away with it. I haven't really dealt with the pain that I caused, not the guilt, but the pain. The guide addresses this by saying, remorse deeply feels the pain of wrongdoing, yet never loses sight of your divinity. So there's guilt, there's real guilt, and there's remorse, which deeply feels the pain that you have inflicted. But remorse does not beat you up and make you bad, because you are not bad, you are divine. And that's what the guide means by, but never loses sight of your divinity. And on the other end of the scale, there's false guilt, which you might have false guilt about something because you don't want to address the real guilt. So again, like being overly dramatic about something, you can become hugely guilty about something that isn't really your fault or you couldn't really control. And what you're actually doing is trying to dodge taking responsibility for a smaller piece, because it never gets looked at because of all this other stuff. So false guilt can be a way of avoiding the hard reality of what you have done that was wrong, requires restitution, and for which, by rights, you should feel remorse. And remorse is part of restitution. There's a difference between saying, I'm sorry, and really getting that you caused pain in another person's life for selfish reasons. Because if you can get that remorse, it is very likely you wouldn't do it again. Once you can truly feel somebody else's pain, it becomes your pain, you go into the unitive, and you wouldn't hurt anybody again after that.
It seems like it would be almost, remorse would be forthcoming more readily if you were never actually able to say I'm sorry to the person, but that you're thinking about what you should be able to say you're sorry about. If that person's not around or is deceased or whatever, mm-hmm. but you still feel that remorse rather than more strongly than you would if you were able to say I'm sorry.
That might be true. One of the things about remorse is it wouldn't linger.
It doesn't linger?
Yeah, if it lingers, it might be some obsessive way of not really feeling the full pain. Once you've done remorse, what are you going to do after that? Once you
just
have
be perpetually remorseful, I guess.
Well, what I'm saying is the difference between remorse and a case of false guilt and moping around bemoaning what you've done but not being able to do anything about it is if you've done remorse and you've done restitution and you've done everything you can, okay, and you can't forgive yourself, then you just need to go deeper and find out what that's about. But banging the drum for your sins, okay, that's not really remorse. Remorse should be finite.
Well, remorse may not linger, but restitution could, huh?
Depends on the restitution.
Yeah.
Okay. But real restitution is an attempt to fully accept, number one, responsibility for what you've done. They accept the cost of what you've done, even if you have to pay in a different format. So, for instance, if I hurt somebody's car, if I come into my driveway and bump my neighbor's car, we share a driveway, and I decide that he can't see it on my car, and I don't have to fess up, so I don't have to tell him that I hit his car. And this person really gets upset and gets angry and blames it, whatever that person does. And then I start feeling bad about it, and then I realize, no, that's not a good thing, and I simply write him a check. I haven't really looked at this. I haven't really grasped what I did. I set off a chain event of things. I unleashed negativity into the world by my simple denial, by my refusal to take responsibility for a relatively small thing that I could obviously afford to cover. Okay?
So you're setting yourself up to do it again if a situation occurs.
Yes. If I think that, oh, that was a bad idea, here's a check, now I'm done. And remorse would include really getting that that was an inappropriate thing to do. Going down deep and really grasping how that, you know, the list of things that it wasn't. Getting the full taste of my own negativity. And at that point, plus the check, okay, I may have made as much restitution as I can. But for instance, if my neighbor carried a grudge for the next 5 years, one of the ways of doing restitution is by simply swallowing the nonsense that person might give you for the next 5 years.
Uh-huh.
Of saying, I deserved this. I lied to this person. And he knows it. So he's going to vent on me. And I really have no defense. Now, you might call a halt to it and say, you know, I appreciate that I was wrong, and I appreciate that I made a mistake, and it was a bad mistake, and I'm very ashamed of it, and I've tried to fix this. But at some point, I need you to stop venting, and so I'm not going to listen. That's different from saying, now, you are worse than I am. Can you get the distinction there?
Yeah.
You don't have to be dumped on by somebody because you made a mistake and you attempted to make restitution. But to turn that around so it's their fault at that point is overreaching.
Mm-hmm.
So I know this is a little esoteric, but I think I can weave something here. In the example of damaging your neighbor's car, trying to hide it, getting caught or admitting and then writing the check, now you have a very, very awkward emotional situation with your neighbor. He knows something about you. He knows that there's a part of you that's a liar and a cheat, even if you eventually fessed up. And that can make you feel shame. And you can wonder sometimes, I wonder if he's told the other neighbor. I wonder if he's told my sister. Because this person's a mean-spirited person, maybe he's telling the whole neighborhood. And then you start looking around, you start becoming paranoid, because it looks like everybody on the street is looking, it turns into a huge deal. Okay? This would be a negative situation where you could say, I'm just paranoid and I'm sure that he's done it and I feel ashamed and I'm beating myself to death. This is an example of fomenting and generating a whole bunch of drama. And I would guess that the underlying part of that is deep shame about having done it in the first place. A place where that person has never fully come to grips with their own lying and thievery.
Yeah, then you could switch blame the other person by saying that it's his place to forgive.
Right. So what I'm suggesting here is that even in that instance, I can be attracting negativity because of my denial. So deep in me is this little tiny piece of denial. Or I think I wasn't that bad. It wasn't that awful. I shouldn't have to endure this. Instead of considering that I'm going to use my own words, for a person of my integrity, that was a mortal sin.
Uh-huh.
My integrity, that was so far off the charts that I need to look at this more deeply. But a person who does look at this deeply and really cleanses his soul and makes restitution, and if that doesn't feel like enough, give more to your church or give time to charity, but make a conscious intention I did a bad act. I engaged in negative activity. I was selfish. I was cruel. I was awful. I'm going to make a campaign out of making up for this. I'm going to over-restitute like crazy. I'm going to make absolutely certain that I have made up for this, internally and externally. If somebody really does that from the bottom of their heart, it has not been my experience that they really deal with a lot of negativity about this. Does that mean that the neighbor will shut up? No. But what happens is you don't take it in because you've cleaned yourself.
That you that's interesting. That,
go ahead.
So you're talking about commission in that way, and I just got to thinking that the sin of omission might be more difficult have remorse for.
Well, it's harder to see sometimes. And if that's the cause, the effect may not be obvious, and it could get past you. But the Catholic lectures are saying is you're still responsible for your sin of omission.
Say that again?
The Catholic lectures are saying that you are still responsible for your sin of omission, even if you didn't notice it.
Huh.
And what we're saying is, but I didn't notice it. Well, how much work have you spent trying to figure out where this negativity could be coming from?
In other words,
sometimes a lot of spiritual work is the result of feeling bad about ourselves. We may not go back and fix what made us feel bad about ourselves. You can't change history. But you can put your life on a different track and take it in a different direction from this moment forward. And perhaps that is the spiritual lesson that you're learning, and so you gave yourself a little weakness in integrity so that this event could happen. So you could ignore it for a while, saying, I don't understand cause and effect here. I just don't get it. And then you start looking. And even if you don't find it, what if you took in the possibility, I may have done something and not seen it. I'm going to make my life more generous. I'm going to become more involved in my... I may not have known what I did. I just know that things aren't right. So I'm going to throw myself into positive activity. I'm going to shift my attitude so that it's cleaner, more positive, that I see what I can see. It doesn't really matter. And this goes back to a question in the first hour about what if we don't know what we did? To some degree, it doesn't matter. To some degree, the spiritual journey, the spiritual task, can come from a gut sense that we did something. And that's enough. This is not a trial. This is not a place where you have to put forward, but I gave 5 cents here and 10 cents there, and the karmic judge says, yeah, but you did this. And that's not what this is. So in the place where you didn't live up to your own expectations, perhaps what you're going to learn to do is go further than your own expectations. And karmically, you have put more positive light and more positive energy in the world, and it will eventually make up for whatever you did. However, I find that a lot of people, upon self-evaluation and self-review, they can find these things. It's not that hard to find where you created negativity, where you contributed to it. And there's a beautiful phrase in the lectures, in the stages of commitment, where one of the questions in stage two, and stage two is about learning to live in community, is can you, I'm paraphrasing unfortunately, can you see in the mountain of untruth that your brother or sister presents to you the one grain of truth? And what that's about is if somebody is trying to tell you that something's wrong, they may tell you in a blaming way, they may tell you in a selfish or self-centered way, they may tell you with an agenda attached to it. That's their stuff. okay? Your job can be a way to hear all that stuff and not be activated, to not react to it, to not take the bait of getting into an argument, and to listen for what might be an element of truth in that that actually means something and can help you become a better person. So at the bottom of this giant mound of criticism could be something that you could work with. And what stage two is about is a way of saying that in community, we are not perfect, and we may present information to you imperfectly. Are you willing to look for the grain of truth in what is said, rather than focus on the mountain of untruth? That's what this work is about. When we are demagnetizing negative force fields, it's not like we're on a charging horse, you know, charging off to destroy a village. That's just not what our lives are like anymore. The negative force fields that we surround ourselves can be criticizing authority figures and generating a sense of rebelliousness, not grounded in fact, but because we're angry. There's negativity in that. So in the demagnetizing of this, where we allow these images to dissolve, we still retain the possibility that our leaders are not perfect. We still have a case-by-case argument on specific items. We still have an opinion. We still vote in certain ways. But we're not trying to paint them as the all-evil, all-terrible, all-awful thing. We're trying to see them as imperfect human beings that hold a truth, that the way they're enacting the untruth doesn't work for us. But again, by holding a negative force field of all leaders are wrong and all politicians are scoundrels and you really need to goose the system and not pay your parking tickets and go on strike, this is not a positive approach. This is not going to build a community. This is
again?
Not...
Again?
Yeah.
It seemed like it's apropos. How do you handle all of the donation requests, which seems to be, they all seem to be worthwhile, but you get tons in the mail of, and even on the phone, of requests for donations for one organization or the other. You seem overwhelmed by them.
So I want to point out a slight confusion here. One is I heard the feeling of overwhelm. And the other was the technicality of being asked by a number of people, and you probably can't meet all their expectations. Okay, I want to separate these two. One is fact, that you will probably not be able to meet the requests of all charities who are soliciting donations. Okay?
Well, you might be able to, but you'd be broke.
What I'm saying, you're not able to, you're not realistically able to.
Right.
So choices need to be made. Okay? That's a simple fact. And it's not for me to answer on that one, but the simple reality is that most of us choose a number and type of charity and an amount to donate that is comfortable for us, and that's where we sit with until we feel uncomfortable about it. But I wanted to segregate out a place of feeling overwhelmed. That has nothing to do with the charity request. The charity requests are the trigger. But overwhelm is a reaction.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And overwhelm would come from a place deep in your childhood where perhaps too many requests were made of you. And in defense, you might have pulled away from all of them,
not knowing which ones to honor.
Right. Now, as a child, there's validity there. You might not have known how to balance, and you might not have known how to say no, and you might not have known how to prioritize. Okay?
Uh-huh.
And yet that sense of overwhelm comes forward in life and attaches itself to something that, and I don't mean to demean your question in any way whatsoever, what to somebody else is a very simple, straightforward question. I pick a charity and that's it. The rest of you have to go look someplace else. The kind of person who can say that quickly and easily, stand with it, and that's their attitude for 20 years, simply doesn't have a childhood drama around being overwhelmed. Okay? But someone who, for 20 years, has never quite been able to figure this out, the thing itself, the charity requests themselves, are a way to draw up this childhood conflict. What I'm suggesting is, in this work, what we're suggesting is that we go backwards and we look at the childhood conflict and help resolve that. Then when we come forward in time, charity requests are simply charity requests. Okay?
So the, a lot of them have hooks, like they send you name labels, and had to put a nickel in or a dime in, or I even got a blanket from an Indian organization.
Yes, but the truth is that when people ask more of us than we can give, there are usually hooks in that too. Okay, so charities are just a manifestation of certain human things. So here's what I'm going to suggest. This sounds like a really rich place for you to work, actually. So this is a really good example of demagnetizing negative force fields.
Say that again.
This sounds like a really good, simple place to practice this lecture.
Uh-huh.
I'm hearing, and I'm only using this as a suggestion, so it may not work, but there's a place where a lot of requests are coming in, and it's disturbing your system. In the disturbing of your system, I don't feel a positive result. Okay? I'm not hearing that you've made a positive decision, that you've seen the light and you now know what to do, and isn't it great that all those requests have led me to a new understanding? I'm not hearing that.
Well, it's not there.
I got it. So that's why I'm saying that's why I'm saying that as just a very, very mild, simple exercise.
Okay.
Might be able to take this lecture and look at the situation and see where you are in negative space with this. And I would call withdrawal and a sense of incapacity to engage negative.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Then you take a look at what is that attitude? Why don't you feel like you can simply prioritize, pick, and tell the other people, I'm so sorry. But this is a place, from such a simple place as getting charity requests, you could come to a place of doing deep personal work. It may not be totally in line with this lecture.
Well, the way I've been dealing with it, of course, just to let those things build up and kind of ignore them and say, well, I'll do something about it later, you know?
Uh-huh. Well, did that work?
No. Okay. I wouldn't have brought it up.
Okay. So the trick is, if it had worked, it wouldn't be a question. So it didn't work. So let's try something else. Okay? So
okay.
Because we're getting very close to the end, there is a wonderful... so I'm going to switch to something real quick, Carrie, because I think we've touched on that, but I don't think that can be resolved here.
Right.
So this, I'm hoping this will tie the lecture pieces together. There is the New Age thing of affirmations. Okay?
Uh-huh.
There is a positive to affirmations, and yet there's a place where they don't work. Okay? Now, if they work for you, great. You're one of the, it works people, so congratulations and let it go. But for those of us who simply look in the mirror every day saying, I wish to be thin and beautiful, and it doesn't happen, we need to look at the possibility that we're not fully on board with this. So when you try to address a problem and it doesn't work, okay, that's when there's something else in there. There's some underlying belief that it hasn't been addressed yet. And the words themselves will not resolve the issue.
The word what?
The words themselves.
Themselves?
Right. In other words, what I'm saying, here's the quote from the lecture that's in 201. It is the thought that must change first.
Right.
In thought lies the intent. This intent can then seep deeper and deeper into the still resisting layers of your consciousness. What I want to point out here is the guide, what we work with in Pathwork is the resisting layers of our consciousness. We are dealing with our own resistance. If there isn't any resistance, there isn't a problem.
Right.
If there's a problem, then there's a resistant layer in your consciousness, a place of conflict that you haven't resolved, where you're withholding, you're acting out, something's not working on a positive level. But to address that, we need to get at the thought first. And a simple affirmation isn't powerful enough to change all those underlying layers.
Right.
And yet the guide gives, there's three or four times in the lectures, the guide gives a, here, try this. And they're really gorgeous. They're really wonderful things. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to go ahead and close by reading this positive affirmation from the lecture. And what I notice about this affirmation is that it is intended to be an open-hearted request for personal strength and perseverance and the ability to see, not magic to be sprinkled on your head, and not for somebody else to do it for you, and not even for somebody else to give you strength, but a deep prayer for greater consciousness. And these are the prayers that I'm suggesting get answered. And if you pray for deeper consciousness, I want to say you're going to get it, but I would have to know that that was a genuine prayer, because if it's not genuine, you won't get it. Okay? Or if it's not genuine, you'll get it and you won't see it. It has not been my experience that when I genuinely, honestly ask for the strength to address an issue, that I didn't feel that I felt that I got strength when I asked for it. I felt that I got insight when I asked for it. And then I got greater consciousness. I got an aha. I got a better sense of what was going on when I asked for it. So here's the meditation. We use this to close. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I do not want to stay in this position. There are powers within me that make it possible for me to change and feel good and secure about the change. I do deserve it. This change is my birthright. I claim this birthright. I can subsist on good feelings. I can sustain them. I can endure them, just as I can endure pain or disappointment. I now decide to no longer believe in the fallacy that either pain or good feelings cannot be born by me. If there are any areas within me where I still battle and defend against either the painful or the love feeling, the giving and receiving of love, the power in me can make me conscious of it and can help me lift myself out of the groove that has been set by the force field of this attitude and bring a new force field into being. I pray for the power, the belief, the faith, and the volition to be totally committed to living my life in a good, in a deeply feeling, in an honest way. What the guide is suggesting is that you can say this, and then you may need to know where you're not fully on board. And that's an area for self-examination. In the self-examination, you may free yourself from a place of resistance. And then you come back and say this again, and you may find another place that feels stuck or resistant, and you work on that. A very, very good Pathwork teacher, Carolyn Tylove, teaches how to read the lectures, and she says, read the lectures until you come to a glitch where you disagree. Stop there, read no more. And the example that she gave when she was teaching was she said, very often when I'm reading a lecture and I read greetings, my dear friends, that's it. I came to read the lecture because I'm stalled right there. I'm not in the mood for greetings, my dear friends.
Right.
I'm arguing with that from the get-go. So my spiritual practice, she teaches, is to allow that to be where I spend my time, working on why greetings, my dearest friend, created an internal argument with me. When I can resolve that, then I can go on. But pushing past that and going on, I'm in resistance and I'm not recognizing it. And reading the lecture may not achieve what I think it will. And I think that encapsulates this lecture. That's all it's saying. That if there's a negative force field, we need to address it. We need to bring ourselves to it. We need to look at what goes on. We need to dissolve this negative force field rather than shove past it as if by shoving past it, it won't exist. So we're out of time, and I very much appreciate all of you joining me. So thank you very much.
Oh, that was a good one.
I'll send out notices about November, so once I figure it out.
Okay, thanks, Jan.
Thank you all. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Jan.